everyone. Good evening and welcome back. This is CKLN 88.1 FM. The show you're tuning into is Friday, Word of Mouth News. My name is Susie Alvarez, and I'm here with you on this Friday, February the 12th. Tonight we have a packed show. We're going to begin with headlines, as we usually do, and then we're going to move on to a feature, and this feature is on the Vancouver's much-anticipated Olympics and all the anti-Olympics actions that are taking place. We're going to be airing an interview with UN Special Rapporteur Milun Kutari, who will be speaking on the subject of housing and displacement in the city of Vancouver as a result of this Olympic Games, which are about to start tonight. And then at 6:30, we're going to turn the mic over to Don White and Anti-Psychiatry Radio. He will be here and will feature an in-studio interview with Juno Award winner folk singer Roger Ellis, who will perform his anti-electroshock song. Don will also share his views and criticisms of the recently published comic book, The Rabble of Downtown Toronto, by Toronto Sun cartoonist Jason Kiefer. And in honor of Black Liberation Month, he will be reading excerpts from a 1983 speech on social justice, particularly commenting on creative maladjustment by the late African-American civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. But before we get to that, we have headlines, and this comes to us thanks in part to various news sources. And we begin in the Caribbean, as Haiti has been struck with its first heavy rainfall yesterday since last month's earthquake. The coming rainy season has raised fears of disease outbreaks and worsening misery for the hundreds of thousands of people still without shelter. Hours after the rain began, hundreds of people marched on the Port-au-Prince airport to protest a lack of tents. The UN estimates nearly 750,000 people have yet to receive any tents or tarps. Even the temporary shelter provided to an estimated 250,000 people will likely be unable to protect them from the rain. And in other news from Haiti, the judge overseeing the case against 10 U.S. missionaries who were charged with kidnapping says he thinks they should be released while awaiting trial. How nice is that? The missionaries were charged last week with child kidnapping after they were caught trying to leave Haiti with a bus load of children. I guess justice is different when we're dealing with North Americans abroad. And in Central America, Costa Ricans have elected their first female president, Laura Chinchilla, who led the ruling party into victory by taking 47% of the vote. Chinchilla, who served as vice president under Oscar Arias, the current president and Nobel Prize winner, has pledged to continue Arias' moderate free market policies. Under Arias' National Liberation Party, Costa Rica has been brought into the Central American Free Trade Agreement with the United States, a very criticized neoliberal trade agreement. And the country has also initiated trade relations with China after a 63-year association with Taiwan. But critics of the government argue that Arias' administration catered to big developers to boost the economy at the cost of the nation's fragile ecosystems. And we go to Iran, where Mahmoud Ahmadinejad declared this Middle Eastern country a nuclear state during a speech made by the president yesterday at a rally marking the 31st anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. The leader's speech came amidst a new crackdown on opposition protests. Numerous opposition figures reported police harassment, while Iranian forces were said to have fired tear gas and paintballs at protesters in the capital city of Tehran. Meanwhile, back in Washington, Senator John McCain helped unveil a measure imposing new sanctions on Iran. Also in the Middle East, Israel has begun rerouting a section of its controversial separation barrier near the West Bank village of Belin following a 2.5-year-old court ruling. but activists and Belene residents continue to hold protest against the barrier, despite the concession, which returns only about a third of the area claimed by the Palestinians. Israel began rerouting the Belene section of the barrier yesterday, 2.5 years after Israel's Supreme Court ruled that the barrier must be moved. Workers laid down tracks for the new route, and once the new section is built, the part of the barrier currently standing around Belene will reportedly be removed. They will return about 700,000 square meters to the Palestinian side of the wall. The separation barrier cuts into the West Bank, away from the so-called Green Line, which marks the ceasefire line agreed at the end of the 1948-49 war that followed the creation of Israel. Activists say that in total, 84% of the barrier will be in the West Bank, often separating Palestinians from their farmlands. And in Malawi, 200 villagers in Blantyre have been ordered by government officials to pack up all their belongings and move to another location. This displacement is a result of proposed plans to build a girls' school on the land. The 15 million all-girl institution is financed by no other than pop singer Madonna and her Malawian charity. For months, the villagers have refused to leave, but recently representatives for the parties involved facilitated $150,000 compensation package to help them relocate. How generous is that? We don't think. The Lilongwe district commissioner told the villagers, quote, "Government allowed you to occupy this land because there was no project yet. But now that Madonna wants to build you a school, you have to give way. You are lucky that Madonna has compensated you for your houses, gardens, and trees," unquote. One of the villagers said his family had lived on that plot of land for three generations and that $1,500 he received will not be nearly enough to replace the house and mango trees that he had in his possession. The European Parliament has voted to end a controversial data-sharing program that's allowed the U.S. to monitor millions of international financial transactions. The records have been obtained through SWIFT, which directs trillions of dollars in international bank transfers each day. The program has been accused of violating privacy rights since coming to light in 2006. Yesterday, European Union lawmakers voted 378-196 to reject a proposed extension of the program negotiated between European Union leaders and the United States despite heavy lobbying on the part of the Obama administration. And the website tomdispatch.com is reporting the number of military bases in Afghanistan now totals around 700. A spokesperson for the U.S.-led NATO occupation force confirmed U.S. and NATO bases outnumber those of the Afghan military by around 400 and 300. The bases range from small sites to mega bases like Bagram Air Base. At least 12 more bases are slated for construction to host the additional 30,000 troops arriving in Afghanistan as part of U.S. President Barack Obama's escalation of the Afghan war. And in local news, the Toronto Star reports that a student protester turned lawyer took his crusade against police wrongdoing to a Toronto small claims court on Tuesday, asking $25,000 in damages for injuries that include being labeled a neo-Nazi in an internal police document. Devin Charney, who is Jewish, also alleges he was wrongfully arrested in January of 2005 at a protest at York University against U.S. President George W. Bush's inauguration. 5 days after the protest, the then U.S. Ambassador Paul Cellucci arrived on campus. Security personnel spotted Charney and arrested him. On the night of Charney's arrest, two officers went to his house. Boot marks in the snow suggested police entered through a rear window when nobody was home, housemate Chris Pheasant testified. Charney has accused police of breaking into his home. His three housemates from the time collectively claimed $10,000 in connection with the police entry. As a student activist, Charney was arrested at least 15 times but never criminally convicted. Now his specialty is taking police to small claims court, and he says he has won $15,000 in such suits for clients. Waterloo Regional Police also paid him $9,000 in an out-of-court settlement. And the last news is an environmental news, and this is through PR Newswire and U.S. Newswire, which reported that this week the Whole Foods Market chain announced its commitment to stop buying transportation fuel linked to Canada's tar sands. Bed and Bath and Beyond also released its new policy encouraging transportation providers to avoid high-impact fuels such as those from refineries using tar sands. Whole Foods and Bed Bath and Beyond are the first companies to publicly reject the tar sands since Forest Ethics launched its U.S. tar sands campaign in July of 2009. Tar sands oil's production generates 3 to 5 times the greenhouse emissions of conventional oil production. Production of tar sands oil destroys fresh drinking water, pollutes the air, and raises North America's critical boreal forest. Communities downstream of tar sand projects face elevated levels of cancer. In addition, tar sands sludge cannot be made clean by technological solutions. And that concludes our segment of headlines for tonight's show. We're going to go to a quick musical break, and we'll be right back with our first feature for tonight's show. So keep it locked on 88.1 FM. News for this Friday, February the 12th. My name is Susie Alvarez, and that in the background is Tricky and the song Excess. Among the complaints of Vancouver's anti-Olympic protesters has been the impact on housing in a city which was already facing a crisis of homelessness. Real estate speculation has forced rents up. Meanwhile, Olympic-related development in the downtown east side of Vancouver has caused a wave of evictions as affordable housing was shut down in favor of upscale hotels. This erosion of Vancouver's housing stock has met with international attention. In 2007, the UN Special Rapporteur on Housing traveled to Vancouver to meet with housing advocates and city officials as part of his Canadian tour. His mandate as Special Rapporteur ended in 2008, but he retains an interest and expertise on the issues. Milon Kutari came back to Canada in late 2009 and toured Vancouver once again. Word of Mouth's Kristen Schwartz caught up with him in Toronto a few months ago and asked him about what he had learned and whether Canada has made any progress since the 2007 report was released. We're going to go now to this interview, so keep it locked on 88.1 FM. Here is Milon Kutari speaking to our own Kristen Schwartz.
Could you tell us about what you observed on your recent trip to Vancouver?
Well, I first went to Vancouver in October of 2007 when I was here on mission for the UN to look at the situation of housing in Canada. And even, you know, before the announcement of the Olympics or the build-up to the Olympics, there clearly was a housing crisis in Vancouver, which had been successively getting worse because of lack of attention at the provincial and the city level on issues like homelessness, long waiting lists for public housing, you know, inadequate and insecure housing, the disproportionate representation of Aboriginal people in the homelessness population, and so on. And subsequent to that, what I observed on this recent trip, and you know, the evidence that is available indicates the situation has actually worsened in terms of the growth of homelessness, in terms of you know, areas like the downtown east side still, you know, suffering from huge housing-related problems. And some of this is attributable to the fact, I mean, we have to look at it another way, say that when the Olympics were, when the bid was made and the commitments were made, there was a commitment, including from VANOC, the Vancouver Olympic Committee, that the legacy of the Olympics would be to leave behind a positive legacy in terms of social housing, that there would be more social housing units built, that there would be, you know, solutions to some of the extreme problems in Vancouver. And I met the chairman of VANOC when I was here on mission, and he actually promised me that as well, that, oh, you know, in the remaining period, we're going to, you know, contribute. And it's very clear to me now when I visited that those promises, they were, you know, false promises. They have not been met. On the contrary, what we see now are, not only has the situation worsened, but also attempts are being made to clear the homeless from the streets. There's something called the Shelter Assistance Act now in place, which is a very draconian piece of legislation, and I actually have said that it's there should be a court challenge to that, because it doesn't seem to me to be consistent with the Canadian Charter, because it essentially calls, it gives the police authority to just pick up anyone and forcibly take them to shelters. And, you know, the local groups there are saying this is like kidnapping the homeless, because they don't have a choice, and it's not using the civic services and all that are available and the civil society facilities, but actually using it as a kind of almost a punitive measure. And to me, it's very curious that a legislation like this is being brought into place now, just before the Olympics. When I was there just a few days ago, I also met the mayor of Vancouver, and he himself expressed, you know, his own displeasure with the act. And the other very disturbing factor, which is related to housing, but is a much, you know, is in a way a broader human rights issue, is the kind of, you know, attack on civil liberties in Vancouver, where you have now more and more cases of activists who are defending housing rights and so on, who are being, there's surveillance on them, people are being questioned, there's intelligence services that are going after them, you know, it's much more difficult in the sort of vitiated political atmosphere there now to work for human rights, and there's something very wrong about that as well. So I think the legacy that the Olympics are leaving in Vancouver from a housing rights but a general human rights perspective is very, very negative.
Did you actually tour through the downtown east side, and, you know, can you make any comment on, you know, how the landscape itself has changed over the last couple of years?
Yes, I toured through the downtown east side both in October 2007 and, you know, a few days ago, and I also had meetings both times with, you know, groups of homeless people in the Carnegie Center. I went also to the Aboriginal, you know, Friendship Center. The neighborhood is still very run down. There's still, you know, a lot of problems, a lot of sort of barricaded areas, closed buildings. What I saw now is that there's a sort of a creeping gentrification of the neighborhood. So and because it is very prime land, I mean, it's in Vancouver, that's really prime area, I think that pressure is there, and that's not very good, because what it would mean is that the force of gentrification, as has happened in cities around the world, because there's so much money behind that, is actually going to, if it is not controlled, it doesn't have to be stopped, but it has to be controlled, is going to lead to the displacement of the people that are there. And not only the displacement, it's going to lead to a destruction of the community sense that the downtown east side has in Vancouver, which very few communities have, you know, in cities across Canada. So it's very important to preserve that community sense. I mean, you can have a mixed-use kind of a policy, but it has to be not at the risk of removing the, you know, the lower income. And actually, For years, people have struggled to retain that community. And there's a very strong artistic component. There's a very strong organizational component with the homeless. There's very, you know, good attempts being made to deal with the drug problem. Very key roles being played by Carnegie Center, by the First United Church, by, you know, many other groups. And this has happened in other cities where Olympics have taken place, where there's a general level of speculation. And then that leads to, you know, either displacement before and, you know, during Olympics or afterwards. And this has happened in Atlanta. It's happened in Beijing. It's happening in my city, New Delhi, where we're going to have the Commonwealth Games next year. And so I think it's, I mean, any talk of a positive legacy of the Olympics, you know, has to look at these issues. And what we can see in Vancouver now is that, I mean, I see it as a lost opportunity because there was an opportunity there for the city to actually use, for the city and the province, to use the occasion of the Olympics to genuinely leave behind a positive legacy. And I think that that opportunity has been squandered to the extent where the credibility of the city, the province, and the country actually is in question now because of this, you know, the growth of the housing problem, homelessness problem, and the attack on civil liberties.
And that was Milan Kotari. He was a former UN Special Rapporteur on housing. He was speaking on the subject of housing and the displacement of various communities that has occurred as a result of the Olympics, which are about to begin today in that city in the province of British Columbia. And as we speak, and as the inauguration of the Games approaches, the DTES, Women's Center of Power, is about to put up Tent City in protest of the upcoming 2010 Winter Olympics, an event that has escalated the homelessness crisis in Vancouver's downtown east side and the greater Vancouver area, as Mr. Kotari just so well described it in his interview. Since the Olympic bid, homelessness has nearly tripled in the GVRD, while real estate and condominium development in the downtown east side is outpacing social housing by a rate of 3-1. Meanwhile, a heightened police presence has further criminalized those living in extreme material poverty in the poorest postal code in Canada. With the eyes of the world on Vancouver, residents of the downtown east side and their supporters will be taking to the streets to affirm their call for justice and dignity. The Olympic Tent Village, a grassroots and autonomous community effort, which will be made public on February the 15th, it will be kept out there in the eyes of the public through online updates. This action is endorsed by over 75 groups and organizations, which include No One Is Illegal. And for more info and updates and to find out how you can support this action, if you cannot join them, if you cannot travel all the way to Vancouver and make your support known, you can visit them online at olympictentvillage.wordpress.com. And before we go, we have just an announcement to make for a very special screening that's taking place tomorrow. So we're going to jump from Olympics to mining, although there's a bit of a connection, as I found out, Tech Resources. A supporter and sponsor of the Games is the official mining and metals provider for the medals. So every time one of those Olympians gets a medal put around its neck, comes to them thanks to Tech Resources, which is a Vancouver-based mining enterprise, and which is working with Nova Gold and has started to build the Galore Creek project, which commenced in 2007 in BC, which met a lot of opposition from the Saikane First Nations. The high-risk copper gold mining project stalled at first, but has recently picked up momentum and steam as Tech announced it will pursue a more aggressive approach. The Olympics, many have observed, has also proven to be a nice platform to use when dealing with investors or courting investors to support the next phase in the development of this very controversial mine. So tomorrow, Saturday, there's going to be a special screening of another controversial Canadian mining project, but this one taking place in Ecuador. The name of the documentary is Under Rich Earth, and it's going to be screened tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. at the Bloor Cinema, which is located at 506 Bloor Street, east of Bathurst. Tickets are $10, but you need to arrive early because they'll only be sold at the door 1 hour before the event. That's when the sales will start. And it's a fundraising event. Now, to give you a bit of background, on January the 19th of 2010, the Toronto Stock Exchange took the unprecedented step of delisting a controversial Canadian junior mining exploration company after years of allegations of human rights abuses in Ecuador. The story behind the extraordinary events that led to this decision is told in the film, which is directed by Malcolm Roux. It's an award-winning documentary film, which has garnered a lot of acclaim and has won prizes in Mexico at the Mexico City Documentary Film Festival, Vancouver International Film Festival, which was nominated also for Best Documentary at the Hamburg International Independent Film Festival, and so on and so forth. You can find more information on this various prizes and nominations it's received at www.underrichearth.com. There will be guest speakers at tomorrow's screening, and one of them is the Honorable John McKay, a member of Parliament for Scarborough-Gilwood. He's a private member. He has introduced a private member's Bill C-300, which seeks to create a framework for transnational corporate accountability in Canadian law. The bill has already passed second reading in the House of Commons and is not affected by Stephen Harper's prorogation of Parliament. There will also be a Toronto lawyer, Murray Kippelstein, representing Ecuadorian farmers who are suing the Toronto Stock Exchange and the Copper Mesa Mining Corporation for violating their human rights. Under Rich Earth, the documentary tells their story of the events and that ultimately led to this groundbreaking transnational lawsuit. So please go out and check it out if you can. It's going to be screened tomorrow. Once again, the time is 6:30 p.m. and the place is going to be the Bloor Cinema, which is located at 506 Bloor Street East. Tickets are $10, and you can find more information at www.underrichearth.com. And that's it for the first half. We're going to go to a musical break, and we'll be right back with Don White and Anti-Psychiatry Radio. Keep it locked on 88.1 FM. This is CKLN, your community radio station.